Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio and also the best cultural show on radio. It's so nice to have you here after all of these holidays are behind us. I'd like to welcome Michelle Yark, our executive producer and co-host of the show. How are you doing, Michelle?
I'm great. Thank you for asking. And you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm doing pretty good today, you know, after New Year's and got through a couple of the bowl games, and now it's kind of settling in a little bit. Anyway, everything going well?
Yes, thank you. Good, good. Just kind of getting into the new year.
What's your big plans?
I'm still working on my resolutions.
Yeah? What is that?
School. Books.
School. I mean, that's been resolved. You're going to school.
I mean, well, I know, but you know, you can resolve to study hard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have no trouble with that. What you ought to do is try to make a B. Try to make a B instead of always like taking the A's in the class. You ought to try to make a B and see how it feels like. I know who knows what I'm talking about. Our engineer, Dean Slum over there. I mean, he knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
How was all of your holidays and New Year's and bowl games? Everything went well for you?
Oh, everything was great. You know, here we are, 2013.
Can you imagine?
Halfway through the first month of 2013.
Halfway through the month already. I can't believe it. How fast time flies. You know what? It's almost Christmas. It's almost Christmas, so you just want to start getting your Christmas list together. It's right around the corner.
11 and a half months.
Anyway, it was a great year. It's a good kickoff to the new year, and I'm real happy about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're a history buff, so.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sure you know what battle victory we celebrated just a few days ago.
Of course I do. One of my favorite battles. I've studied the battle plan.
Oh, really?
I've been to the site on numerous occasions. I've actually crouched behind the earthen embankments. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I've looked at the cannons with the cannoneers in full dress, I might mention. Mm-hmm. And then went into the museum to study the battle plan with an Englishman, I might mention. And as we were standing there at the Battle of New Orleans site, right there at Chalmette Plantation, that final battle of the War of 1812, whose outcome saved the city of New Orleans, the independence of a nation, created a president, and standing there with an Englishman, who, of course, the Americans fought at that battle, he says, now, let me get this right.
Yeah.
8 Americans killed and 10,000 Englishmen in the army. He says, quite an exaggeration, I think. I said, whoa, 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 this is history here. This is the truth, Louisiana style. Absolutely.
Louisiana style. There's the caveat. But, you know, they do call this the Forgotten War.
The War of 1812.
But it was a very important one.
Are you kidding me, huh?
And, you know, when you look at the odds, the English infantry versus a group of motley New Orleanians.
At best.
You know, the odds weren't really with New Orleans.
Well, I want everybody to picture a disorganized fighting group. Slama, you want to really listen. I mean, this is another part. Just like for Christmas, I taught you how to do the Yule log and all that. You want to understand what's happening here. This is an important part of your history. Get your little pad and pencil there. I want you to picture a disorganized fighting group of Creoles, frontiersmen, Indian sharpshooters, free men of color, a notorious pirate and his brigade led by an American general called Old Hickory, all standing right there against an 8,000 member elite British Army and Navy. Our army, if in fact you could call it that, our motley crew was about half that size.
And you know, the British had just defeated Napoleon at Waterloo. So, I mean, they were sharp. And they were out to crush this little fragile upstart nation. By 1812, they had burned the White House. They had the East Coast under a naval blockade. Their plan was to take control of all the inland waterways. And, of course, the Mississippi River was kind of the jewel in the crown.
Yeah, and with that, of course, they could come back and take what they figured was rightly theirs. But to do that, they had to take control of New Orleans, and they didn't plan on the resistance that they would meet. The British Navy had established a base by this time in Florida, and they were just patrolling the Gulf of Mexico. They knew that they had to go through the bayous and backwater to get to the city, and they gambled that they would have an ally in a certain pirate of Barataria, the notorious and infamous Jean Lafitte. And Lafitte and his men were wanted by the Americans, and the Baratarians were under threat from an American assault. But, you know, Lafitte was also a gambler, so the British were thinking, well, okay, he's going to want to be with us because the Americans are after him. And he was thinking, I really want to be an American. So gambling that the Americans would win, Lafitte declined that British request and instead wrote a note to Governor Claiborne, very famous note that said, "I am the stray sheep wishing to return to the sheepfold."
He was quite the negotiator, wasn't he?
Absolutely. Well, that's why they call him a corsair, a gentleman rover, a pirate.
You name it. Well, his plea obviously worked because Governor Claiborne freed his brother Pierre from jail, and he also requested that the U.S. Attorney General grant a pardon for the Baratarian privateers in return for their allegiance in the Battle of New Orleans. Of course, Jackson wasn't that popular in the area. You know, he had a timid stomach.
Yeah, he had a timid stomach. And, he hated the Creoles. He hated the food. He didn't want to be in Louisiana. He just wanted to get back out of here, go back home.
Yeah, and for some reason, he just didn't trust Lafitte.
And he didn't trust Lafitte, absolutely. And why would he do that? But, of course, Lafitte was known as a privateer, as you mentioned. Most pirates, you know, went in and confiscated goods from any ship coming into the Gulf of Mexico, whereas privateers only confiscated goods from enemy ships. And so Lafitte was thinking, I'm doing America a favor, so don't bug me. I'm only stealing from ships that's coming in here as your enemy. I'm not touching all the good stuff or American goods. But anyway, Andy Jackson, even though he didn't trust Lafitte, he didn't have a choice. Let's face it, when he arrived in New Orleans in early December, he found a totally defenseless city, one with no bulwarks, only two fighting ships, I think, in harbor. He had to place his trust in Lafitte as a last resort, because Lafitte was not only the only source of ammunition. He had boats, he had men, he knew the backwaters, he knew the swamps. You know, in exchange for pardons for those who agreed to defend the city, Lafitte and many of his men joined the New Orleans militia, manned the ships, and formed artillery forces to battle the British. So, I mean, the city actually won out big time with that deal.
Absolutely. They built up the ramparts at the Rodriguez Canal. It was a 150-foot-wide ditch, basically, that separated the Chalmette and McCarty plantations. And then on Christmas Day, the attack began. One British column marched on them from the river and the other from the swamp. You can kind of visualize that. And thinking about the chill in the air and some of those foggy mornings that
very,
we have.
Very foggy. It was listed as a really foggy, kind of drizzly morning. It was cold. The plantation home was over to the right. You know, you could see it, kind of columns coming out right across this huge field. And if you can envision about 6 football fields in length from the embankments where they were, and they had to dig these out. I mean, this little motley crew had to dig this embankment, this rampart, as they called it on Rodriguez Canal. They had to dig it out and kind of put wood down there for them to stand on. It was raining, so you know the ditch was full of water, right? And most people think it was the first guerrilla warfare ever fought, because the soldiers were in trees, they were embankments, they weren't like marching columns as the British was. And
Pakenham arrived Christmas Day. They did a little skirmish there, but they delayed. Well, the British delayed.
Yeah, well, most people think that the greatest Christmas gift to the Americans in New Orleans was the fact that the British Army and Navy waited for General Pakenham. They wanted Pakenham to come from England, meet them, I think it was around Mobile Bay or wherever he met them, so that he could take the city. They wanted Pakenham to have this huge jewel in the crown to be able to go back to the king and say, here's America. Here's the country that we founded at Plymouth Rock, and we've given it back to these Americans on July 4, 1776. But now, 1812, it's yours again. Here's your Christmas gift. So they waited for him. You know what I mean? 1815, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Anyway, as you say, you know, the attack began on that early morning. And again, on New Year's Day, the British pounded the American makeshift fortress. And again, they were repelled by this motley crew. We mm-hmm. talked about this guerrilla warfare. Then on January the 8th, the British General Pakenham made his full-out frontal attack. Now he's coming in to just take the city. Yeah. And of course, you can imagine, he's going to walk right into New Orleans. It's easy pickings. They had already done so much damage across the country up to this time, from Fort McHenry all the way down to the Gulf. Sending columns of troops advancing just across that open field, shoulder to shoulder, the drum and fife corps going. The Tennessee and Kentucky sharpshooters picked them off like ducks in a gallery. You know, taking down Pakenham himself on the first volley. He was killed. The defeat was astounding. The British actually suffered 2,057 casualties to the Americans, 71. A defeat from Creole pirates, backwood hunters. I mean, just as you rightly said, a motley crew.
But we can't forget to give credit to divine intervention as well, because you know what a huge part the Ursuline nuns played
in
the city of New Orleans. Really, from right after the time Bienville established the city, while the battle raged the night before and the morning of, New Orleans was deep in prayer under the leadership of the Ursuline nuns. They all gathered in, I believe it was St. Mary's Chapel, and the nuns prayed, and members of the city prayed with them, and they beseeched Our Lady of Prompt Succor to save the city.
Absolutely. So Our Lady of Prompt Succor was prayed for all night. And, of course, we thank you sisters for all of the prayers. And Ursuline still have a special mass. If you can imagine this, because this was their promise, mm-hmm. Our Lady of Prompt Succor, that if New Orleans won the battle and the United States would be saved, so to speak, New Orleans would be saved, that a special mass would be held every January 8th into perpetuity in thanksgiving for New Orleans' victory. But a bit irony of it all is that in the midst of all of this, a peace treaty ending the war had already been signed between the British and the United States at Ghent, Belgium, the Treaty of Ghent. The war that had officially ended on paper came to a resounding close with the battlefield defeat of the British Army. Y'all, today we're talking about the battle in New Orleans. It took place just a couple of days ago.
The anniversary, yeah.
Yep, one of the most important victories in nation's history. We'll return. We have a great guest to tell us more about it. And I'm going to cook a little something from that battlefield. We'll be back in just a moment.
To save the city, ruin and rage keep pouring down. Flood bomb, blood and pity. Well, the angel of death soon hear me now. Hold now, don't break. Hold now.
Greetings. Move to KRVS every Sunday night for 2 hours of hardcore classic Rasta reggae radio right here on Jamon. Jamon, Sunday nights 9 to 11 p.m., Saturday mornings 1 to 3, here on KRVS, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Hi, this is Kate Earl, inviting you to visit E-Town this week. I'll be joined by Nick and Helen, ALO, and the winner of the Achievement Award. That's this week in E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
There's a car, truck, or boat taking up space at your house, and you're finally ready to do something about it, KRVS just might be the answer. Your vehicle could be used to support public radio in our community through KRVS's car donation program. One phone call is all it takes. Whether it's running or not, we'll come and get the vehicle, send you a tax receipt when it sells, and you just supported KRVS. Call us now at 877-KRVS-887 or visit our website at krvs.org to learn more. And thanks.
KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We took a little bacon and we took a little beans, and we caught the bloody British in a town in New Orleans. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best food and culture show on radio. And today we're talking about the Battle of New Orleans, needless to say. And Michelle, we have a great, great guest with us. And I said I was going to cook a dish from the battlefield.
From the battlefield.
From the battlefield.
From that era.
From that era, absolutely.
Well, we do have a great guest today, straight from the Chalmette battlefield, in fact, in Jean Lafitte National Historical Park and Preserve. We have Park Ranger Nathan Hall with us. Now, Nathan is originally from Fredericksburg, Virginia.
That was a big battle there, you know, Fredericksburg.
Yes.
The Battle of Fredericksburg. That's right.
Very much so. So it's not really all that surprising that he chose to pursue a career in history. He got his undergraduate degree in history from Virginia Commonwealth University.
Wow.
And then he began working with a private sector museum. And, of course, some of his later jobs placed him at various historic institutions, as you might imagine, an 1812 Richmond home, a pre-Revolutionary War fort in eastern Virginia, a diplomatic legation to the Texas Republic in Austin. He earned his master's degree in American history at LSU.
Oh, wow. So he ended up here.
He ended up here. God's country, well, so
God,
to speak.
Absolutely.
He specialized in the legal history of the federal period.
Wow.
He's a park ranger for the French Quarter Visitor Center and the Chalmette Battlefield. But he puts his love of history and education to good use every day by sharing his knowledge of Louisiana history with all the visitors that come from around the world. And it is indeed a pleasure to welcome Nathan to the radio show. Hi, Nathan. How are you?
Hello. Good morning. I am wonderful. Great to be here.
Nathan, thank you so much. How have you been? Pretty good, I hope.
Yeah, I'm enjoying a little bit of winter.
Well, not winter from your homeland back up. Well, I guess it is northern south or southern north.
Huh?
It does get pretty cold up in Virginia. Huh?
Sometimes, yeah.
But anyway, so nice to have you with us. You know, like you, we are lovers of history as well. I have so enjoyed my many visits to the battlefield. And of course, as you may know, I've done a couple of PBS shows from that area as well. And we jokingly say we can bore people for hours with our little known facts that we like.
Oh, yeah.
As I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. As people say, well, what are you talking about? You know. But anyway, we've had such a great time with the battlefield. Y'all have done such an unbelievable job over there. And now you find yourself in that place. Tell us a little bit about your career path that kind of got you all involved in history and how you eventually arrived in Louisiana.
Been an interesting path, as you mentioned. I've worked at an old fort from 1611 in a legation to the Texas Republic and an old 1812 house, and decided at some point it was time to try out academia, go continue the education, get the master's degree. I looked at colleges around the country, and I looked at where would I want to possibly stay when I was done if I was looking for a job. So I had a very limited number of places I applied. LSU was one of them, with the hope I might land a job in New Orleans, and I got very fortunate to land one of the best jobs I could get for the National Parks down here.
Wow, that's fantastic. Congratulations. And we're happy to have you, too. Very happy to have you.
You know, Nathan, one of the things that's always intriguing are the reenactments that happen at so many of these spectacular historic sites. And I know at the Virginia Fort, I believe y'all did reenactments there. How similar is it to the Chalmette battlefield? Because y'all do this annually, if I'm not mistaken.
Every year we have our big show. Yeah, it's January 12th this year. We pick a convenient close Saturday to January 8th, the date of the actual battle. And we have living history encampments. We always say it's not a reenactment in the strictest sense, and that we're not standing on opposite sides of the field shooting at each other, since we're federal land and we are extra safe. But we do everything that you do in the camp. We demonstrate our cannons. We demonstrate our muskets. We just fire them off in safe directions. We did the same thing at my old 1611 fort, except it was a little more complicated in those days before you had the those days carrying around a smoldering piece of match in one hand and your gunpowder in the other. It was very different technology 200 years before the Battle of New Orleans.
It's kind of hard to think of the Battle of New Orleans as being more technological.
Huge convenience to have flints and steels in my muskets now.
Wow.
Michelle, were you with me when we did the PBS shoot at the battlefield?
I was with the last one when we did the encyclopedia series.
Okay, because I was lucky that they got in full uniform, and not only the film crew, but the photography. Ron Manville was there shooting these beautiful pictures of the cannoneers. I said, we're going to shoot it, right? And he said, yeah, you want to shoot it? I said, I want to shoot it. So I had that pleasure the first time of being with those guys. I mean, it was just incredible to see it working and how hospitable it was there. What a beautiful sight.
Nathan, we were talking a little bit about the battle and leading up to the days of the actual victory for New Orleans. We're always hearing some of these myths. I mean, part of your job as a historian there, I'm sure, is also part folklorist, because so many myths about the battle have developed over the years. And even when we were writing about the Battle of New Orleans in the Encyclopedia of Cajun and Creole Cuisine, it was kind of hard sometimes to separate fact from fiction. So I have to ask the expert, was Pakenham really pickled in a barrel and sent home?
That actually is
Did
a,
that
a
happen?
True yes. It's interesting. Yes, no alligator cannons. but there are two generals killed on the field, and they have the honor of getting to be taken back home, and that's really the only way to do it in those days.
A barrel of rum or brandy?
I thought.
Now, what the actual liquid was, I guess I haven't seen the primary source in a while.
Jean Lafitte, you know, we were talking about him a little bit earlier, and we know he kind of negotiated the arms deal, so to speak, in exchange for liberty and being free of all of his
crimes at sea.
Yeah, but I understand he wasn't even on the battlefield when the battle actually occurred. Is that true?
Well, like so many things in the history of this era and this battle, I can say likely, and there's almost nothing that I can say with absolute certainties, but we don't think so. As an historian, you know, we love to tell the stories and then say, go back to our primary source and say why we think what we do. And that is, on the morning, you have your battle, you have your attack, and by afternoon, you've got General Jackson writing dispatches and sending them around. So he sent a dispatch to Mr. Lafitte across the river at English Turn, a few miles away. So that's my understanding. Now, there are more than one Lafitte out there as well. So there are John
that's
Pierre.
Right. Yeah, that's Pierre.
So,
yeah. Yeah.
Like so many things, when I discuss history, I say, if you want to believe he's there, I can't prove that he's not, but I can offer you this evidence that he's very likely not. And, of course, that does not take away from his contribution.
No, right. Now, you know, also, one of the things that certainly intrigued me as we studied the battle and wrote from whatever documentation we could find in New Orleans in the historical sites there, it seems so odd that the British would have kind of sat back and waited. It seems that they were waiting for Pakenham to show up, because I guess they could have probably easily won the Battle of New Orleans pretty handedly had they not given Jackson time to get his motley crew together and not get his soldiers together and dig out Rodriguez Canal and all the things they had to do. Is there any fact-fiction understanding as to what was the real story about Pakenham's arrival for that battle?
The fleet with the soldiers dispatched, you know, sometime before the general did. But, you know, we think of January 8th as our big Battle of New Orleans, and you think that conception of, you know, rank-and-file British soldiers just marching across an open field. And what we have the opportunity to do at the battlefield is tell it as a story of a six-week campaign. It's not just one day. It's little decisions that you make that make the battle play out the way it does and make January 8th happen. But that stage is set on December 16th, when you have a battle on the lake, and on December 23rd, when there's a skirmish further down the river. So you look at it as an overall big picture of the small decisions that generals make that add up to, you know, victory or defeat. You have to be making very good decisions as a general in order to win, but you also have to be lucky. And the campaign here leading up to January 8th is a case of General Jackson making some good decisions and being very, very lucky, General Pakenham making some poor decisions that add up, and also being very unlucky.
Right, right. Huh? And though Jackson was really, you know, obviously the hero of that battle, it's pretty well known that New Orleanians didn't really care that much for him, nor did he care that much for New Orleanians. What's the story about that?
like so much in history, there are multiple perspectives. You have some people, Andrew Jackson, you have a point of view of him kind of riding into town, clamping the city down in martial law and, you know, putting in jail anybody who disagrees with him. But you also have a story of volunteers coming forward to defend their home. Andrew Jackson, of course, is an American patriot through and through. New Orleanians sometimes were, sometimes were not, but part of the interesting thing about this story is that you can be an American patriot or you can have other interests, but you can also chip in and help out in the battle. You can defend your home and you can defend your country, and afterwards they start to feel more like the same thing. History doesn't often have one simple answer. There are always.
Now, in the world of battles, I mean, we have so many great ones to study and to raconteur about, as we say. How important in American history was the Battle of New Orleans?
You know, it's interesting because comparatively it's a small number of people when before and after you have hundreds of thousands of people fighting in Europe on that continent. And over here you have an army of a few thousand people on each side really determining the shape of the American continent. The Louisiana Purchase was pretty fresh and pretty new. It had been about a dozen years. This was a city that didn't have that many Americans in it. So this was the challenge to New Orleans, which controls the whole Purchase. So defending this city means that America will keep New Orleans and Louisiana. That also means America will expand west without the European powers in the way. So depending on your perspective, that can be a good thing or a bad thing. And Manifest Destiny will continue later in the century. And this war up on the Canadian frontier, again, comparatively few thousands of people involved on either side, determine that Manifest Destiny isn't going north. So we have the continent really shaped the way we do because of what happened in this war and on this little field we have out here at Chalmette.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
That's really incredible. John, I think a few years ago you were saying that Chef David Chambers came down. He's from England, and y'all went out on the battlefield. And
yeah, David Chambers, a great chef, wanted to experience the battlefield inside because he said he had heard so much about it, even in school. They had talked about this battle in Louisiana, and then once we became friends, he came to Louisiana for a holiday, and then he said, how far away is that battlefield at the end? I took him there. I didn't want to cut you off.
But no, but I've heard you tell the story that he stood on the battlefield, and of course, being an Englishman, and the numbers of the fallen soldiers was so great on the British side, and comparatively so few on the American side. He was like, I don't know if I believe this.
American folklore, right?
But what about the burial of the dead? We know that the officers went back home, the English officers, as we said, in the pickled in barrels. But what about the infantrymen? What happened to them?
The generals are the only one that get the privilege of going back home to be interred, and the rest are interred out here on the field. They put out a truce that morning, drew an imaginary line down the middle of the field. Anybody on one side, British or American, came back to the American line and was interred, and anybody on the other side was interred back in the British camp. And we don't exactly know where that is. It's out there somewhere, still there.
Wow.
So that's something to bear in mind. We have our national cemetery from the Civil War era, thousands of veterans from almost all the American wars here, and that gives us pause when we have our gravestones there. But it's also something to know when we look out over that field that somewhere out there are the unmarked gravestones of all of the British soldiers.
Right. Well, and it is something to remember when we're out there because we owe our respect to them, having died in battle. Considering that we're in the middle of the three-year celebration of the War of 1812, do y'all have anything special that you're doing at the park to commemorate the battle or commemorate that period?
Well, yes, we started off. It was handy that in April we could celebrate two things at once, and that is Louisiana statehood and commemorating the beginning of the War of 1812 happen within a few weeks of each other. Louisiana becomes the newest state. America declares war on Great Britain. And so we had a small event here with our living historians. We have amazing volunteers who come out here on a regular basis, not just for the big event every year, but also throughout the year to portray civilians in New Orleans and to portray the local New Orleans militia. We had the big event with the tall ships from all around the world. That was a kickoff event. Sailing ships from around the world docked in the French Quarter and around that neighborhood to commemorate the beginning of the war. They've sailed off, and they're going from port to port throughout the 3 years. We'll have our sort of small continuing events, the big anniversary every year, and expanding our living history programs throughout the year. Largely, we'll be doing like the New Orleanians. The war begins. We're very far away from the East Coast in Canada where the war was expected to be fought. So the war begins, statehood begins, and we sort of wait for it to come to us. So our biggest focus, of course, is going to be on 2015, but we will continue to do what we always do and tell that story on a daily basis out here.
Nathan, I know that parks and our wonderful resources that continue to teach our children and generations yet to come about the things that happened here. I know it's always so tough on funding and dollars coming in and continued restoration of these sites and all of this. Where's the majority of the funding coming from, and what kind of help do you folks always look for to make sure that the investment there is constantly coming in from people of interest?
Well, of course, most of the money comes from you and me, our American tax dollars at work, the Department of the Interior and the National Park Service federally fund the site. And beyond that, we like to do partnerships with local groups. The Historic New Orleans Collection is a partner of ours. We work with them a lot. They're downtown, and we get a lot of help from St. Bernard Parish resources and assistance. And one of the best investors we have is our living history people, reenactors. We have, you know, 100, 150 of them come out every year, more every year. They devote not only their time, but their effort and their money. They suit themselves up and bring out their camp equipment, and they're our partners in telling this story as well. So, of course, everyone's always welcome to come out and help and volunteer in any way, because we do the best we can with what we have, and we do a great job because we're really dedicated and all of us very happy to be doing what we're doing, and help is always appreciated as well.
Well, we appreciate all that you guys are doing out there. We're needing to wrap up a little bit, but before we go, tell us a little bit about the monument there at the park.
Oh, yes. We have an obelisk in that sort of Egyptian style. They sort of conceived of it within 15 years of the battle. Story goes that they put on a cornerstone in 1840, but they didn't start building it until 1855. You know, raising money is always difficult. It was a private, the state wanted to build a monument. They were daughters of the War of 1812. So they began to build a monument, got it about two-thirds of the way done, and then we had that Civil War going on in the 1860s, so that stops our construction. And so for most of the rest of the century, we had a two-thirds finished obelisk sitting on our field. And it was in 1908 that it was finally completed. The federal government took it over and capped it off, and we now have Memorial Obelisk right behind the line, right in the midst of the American line here at New Orleans.
Well, Nathan, in closing, I want to thank you and the whole team there for the great work that y'all do. I also want to mention that Michelle and I both are great history buffs and certainly write quite a number of books on the subject. And our new restaurant, Revolution, which is dedicated to the preservation and promotion of all things great in Louisiana, we certainly like to maybe throw a little hint out there that maybe we'd be interested in doing something at some point, maybe at next year's event or whatever, that may be a little fundraiser for a particular thing that y'all might be interested in doing. We're always interested in recreating some of the foods of that era.
I'm always interested in eating the food of that era. That will work out very well.
Well, keep us in mind if there's something special that y'all want to do on, in the next year or year to come that we might be able to help you with. We're all ears because we appreciate and want to encourage all of our listeners traveling through the state or listening to us via the world. Please know that that wonderful John Lafitte National Historic Park is there for your enjoyment, and y'all will see you in just a little bit. So, Nathan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Y'all don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a minute.
The trumpets sound, the colors flying. Hire my boys to fight, kill, or wound. Content with our hard fare, my boys on the cold ground. Why, soldiers, why?
Shakespeare's Othello has inspired everything from orchestral overtures to Hollywood movies to a rock opera. But the most lasting interpretation of the drama is surely the great tragic opera by Verdi. I'm Lisa Simeoni. Join me for Verdi's Othello in a production from La Fenice in Venice next time on World of Opera.
Monday night at 7 on KRVS.
At the crossroads of the Western Hemisphere, Panama is home to some seriously eclectic music.
Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. Join me as we listen to tropical soul, calypso funk, and Spanish reggae from the Isthmus. It's the Panama Beat. Next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Konnichiwa, this is Emily with Rock Japan, inviting you to join me late night Fridays at 3 a.m. and Mondays at 11 p.m. here on KRVS 88.7 FM. We'll explore the new, old, and experimental music of the island nation of Japan and how they rock the world from dusk till the rising sun.
From the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, this is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, now broadcasting in HD radio technology.
It oft times has been told that the British seamen bold could flog the tars of France so neat and handy, oh. But they never met their match till the Yankees did them catch. Oh, the Yankee boys for fighting are the dandy, oh. The Guerriere, a frigate bold, on the foaming ocean rolled, commanded by proud Dacres, that brandy, oh. With his choice of British crew, as ever a rammer drew, they could flog the Frenchman 2-1.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to the best tasting food and culture show on radio. Today we're talking about the anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans. We have a great recipe to give you, of course. Dean, what about our Facebook communication?
Well, we got a contest we're rolling out right now.
Yeah.
It's fired up. David Hubble has submitted his already,
sure. I knew David would. I knew David would come on through.
Yeah. Basically, what we're doing is we're asking our stovehounds, our listeners, to come on to our website, our Facebook page. That's Stirring It Up Radio, STIRRIN, It Up Radio. And we're looking for your most proud cuisine.
The one you stick your chest out for, if you're a guy.
Yeah, this is my recipe.
This is my recipe and stay away from it, but you can taste it.
We're looking for that recipe, whether it's an entree or a side dish or maybe even a beverage.
Yeah, whatever.
Beverage of choice, that could be a good one.
You know, everybody, especially, you know, during these past holidays and then coming up to all these big games we have coming up here, and, of course, the Easter season and Mardi Gras and all. I mean, everybody has that famous recipe that they're always asked to bring to the party. Mm-hmm. That's the ones we're looking for.
That's what we're looking for.
Yeah, we want people to share that with us and take a picture of it, but we also want to see some family activity. And just go to our Facebook page, Starting It Up Radio, and send it to us, and then we're going to kind of judge it, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to have that person invite that person, that stovehound, to be a guest on the show and then cook with us. And we're looking for those recipes to come on in. And this isn't a one-time thing. I mean, it's kind of like an ongoing thing, so our stovehounds can become part of the show. Every month, maybe we'll have one on. Right, Michelle?
That's right. And, you know, we've got something else going on.
There's a lot going on.
I guess so.
The boucherie dinner.
Yeah, revolutionary.
How are those pigs coming?
Well, the pig pens, you know, Slam, I got to give you some pictures of the pig pen. You want to load them up today? I got some pictures of the pig pen.
Yeah, 32
feet long, 16 feet wide. Everybody thought I was building the fort at Chalmette.
Round
you really
two.
Need poles that big, 3 foot deep, cemented in to hold a pig? I said, the pigs we get, and we do. Anyway, yeah, I'm going to give you some pictures to load up on the website our Revolutionary Boucherie. We're bringing in two heritage breed hogs, one the big black and the other one a red wattle. Mm-hmm. We're going to do a Hereford, too, at some point. And we're going to get them up to about 250 pounds, and then we're going to do a boucherie. And we're going to invite 50 charter members. That means they get first choice every year.
Right. And this is open to anybody who's interested in participating. We've set the date for Sunday, February 24th.
February 24th at Revolution Restaurant, 777 Bienville Street, New Orleans. That's where we're actually going to do the Revolutionary Boucherie dinner. Wine and food and everything being served.
Yeah. Exactly. We're loading all that information onto the website. If you want to participate in that, The way to do it is to contact Restaurant Revolution, because they have the master list, and that's where you register, so to speak, and make your reservation.
Yes.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, and they say, I want to be a part of Revolutionary Boucherie Dinner that's taking place on
February 24th. Yeah. It's a Sunday evening.
And anybody can come and visit the pigs. And I told people the other day, they can't name them. My grandfather used to always say, you can't name a pig if you're going to eat it. Can't name that pig. Stay away from these pigs.
You know what I like about the pigs is that their dinner consists of a little glass of red wine.
Oh, no.
Absolutely. Acorns, red wine.
Come on.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
You were doing the Krispy Kreme diet. Isn't that what Nathan was talking about?
But at White Oak Plantation, where we have the pig pens, we're also putting in the chicken yard and all the smokehouse. We got the smokehouse going in. I think everything's going to be in place by, I don't know, maybe the middle of January. I put the gate up myself the other day, and the gate hanging ceremony on the pig yard.
Well, you chop, chop. You got this week.
Well, I know, but the pigs are
being.
Yeah, but
I'm just
hold
saying.
On. My pigs are coming from Black Hill Farms in Texas. Black Hill Farms, one of the top heritage breeders of pigs, and they have my pigs sectioned off and they're feeding them for me. Anyway, y'all, all very serious stuff here, and we'll have all of the charcuterie, the meats that are so beautifully cured, and the sausages, five hors d'oeuvres, and appetizers, and then everything on the main meal will be pork related from those two heritage breed pigs. So we're going to do, I mean, it's going to be a magnificent dinner.
Dessert.
This won't be fooling around. I'm going to tell you right now, this will be a revolutionary boucherie dinner at Revolution. So y'all check that out and go to our Facebook page and share anything you want with us, including topics, etc. What about books, Michelle, on the big show today for your library?
Yes, I do have two recommendations. The first book that I want to recommend, if you want to learn a little bit more about the War of 1812 and the Battle of New Orleans, it's a book by Robert Remini. It's The Battle of New Orleans, Andrew Jackson and America's First Military Victory. Remini actually won the National Book Award for his 3-volume history of Andrew Jackson. Great historian and great books that he's penned. He includes much about Andrew Jackson's role in the war, discusses the importance of the victory as the one that preserved our nation. The second book that I have for everybody, in the spirit of this being a battle against the British, is Great British Cooking, A Well-Kept Secret by Jane Garmy.
Now, most people would take that in jest, you know, Great British Cooking. But as you well know, having just come back from London a few months ago, and the countryside, I mean, there's some unbelievable food there.
There really is a lot of fabulous Great British Cooking. And this is a wonderful little book. You know, England is famous for their meat pies, for their puddings. You have to love the names of a lot of their dishes. Bubble and Squeak.
Right, right.
You know, Cocky Leaky Soup.
Yeah.
I mean, the name alone makes you want to cook it. Or at least taste it. So this is a collection of old and new British recipes adapted for American cooks. And both of these books, I think, would be wonderful additions for your culture and culinary library. We have all the information loaded up onto the website, so you can learn more about them.
No, absolutely. And talking about recipes, y'all, we did have some choices today. Michelle, I always like to have choices. So today I was kind of meandering through the three choices. First, you know, since it was the battle in New Orleans, we thought maybe we should look at an English version of a good Louisiana recipe, and that is Lost in the Marsh Venison Pie.
I kind of like that.
But this could be Lost in the Marsh Game Pie as well, because you could put any game in this pie, which is great. And that's the way it was done at the Battle of New Orleans. You could do squirrel and rabbit or venison. Venison was in that time of year at the battle. Anything could go into this Lost in the Marsh pie. And it's in After the Hunt cookbook, by the way.
Can you imagine the stories and the tales that went on around the campfires as preparing for battle and cooking up these dishes and reminiscing and looking forward?
Yeah, I could see them sitting around the fire at the Battle of New Orleans, and they're doing a rabbit and squirrel sauce pecan, which is one of my choices for a recipe today. It starts off with, man, I tell you, the biggest rabbit I ever killed. Because that was one about 2 feet long before I left home. You know, another guy said, you never saw a rabbit up in Tennessee where we from. You know, so that's where the Cajun stories begin, right there. And then, of course, somebody says, well, see, you're putting squirrel in that thing. I don't eat squirrel myself. And when I do a sauce pecan, you know, I like to put blah, blah, blah. I could just hear those things going in. What about the heat? And here's some old guy, some old Los Islanos, you know, from Chalmette. bringing all those hot peppers with them from South America, you know, and from the islands. You can imagine what that.
Ooh.
Put some heat in that thing. Get some heat in that pot. So, and then, of course, there was also a lot of rice in those days, and they would cure the grapes and make raisins out of them by sun drying. And then, of course, they'd macerate them in rum. There was a lot of rum there. You know what I mean, Slama? Huh? A lot of rum on that battlefield.
Mm.
So little raisins macerated in rum and then put into leftover rice to make a wonderful, what we would call riz au lait, rice and milk, a nice rice pudding. That's my choices today. I think I'm going to go with the Lost in the Marsh game pie. What do you think?
Go with the game
like that,
pie.
Like that?
Yeah.
Huh? I think that's what we're going to go with. Tis the season now. A lot of game. People want to clean out the freezers. And, y'all, I encourage you, even though I'm using 2 pounds of ground venison here, I would encourage you to use 2 to 3 pounds of mixed game meat. You can put rabbit, squirrel, duck, goose. Anyway, y'all, Lost in the Marsh game pie. It's going to take you about 2 hours to do this. It's going to serve about 6 folks. And, you know, anybody traveling as we did, Michelle, through, and we did eat the English shepherd's pie, if you remember the shepherd's pie, and there's so many different versions of it. The shepherd's pie, of course, can have lamb in it, or pork, or beef, and mashed potatoes on top of it. And I'm using venison, as I said, in this dish, but I would encourage you to just kind of get 3 different game. You could get rabbit, venison, and duck would be perfect. And you don't have to ground it as I'm doing here. You can actually cut it into 1/4-inch cubes, mm-hmm. and then go ahead and put it together. So what we're going to do, we're going to start off with 2 pounds of this meat. Let's start off by preheating the oven to 350. We're going to boil about 4 nice white potatoes, peeled and cubed, 1-inch cubes. You're going to boil them in, cover them by 2 inches in lightly salted water. I actually put salt and pepper in my water when I boil potatoes that I'm
going to
mash. Yeah, sure. Why not season them while they're boiling? I even boil them in a little chicken stock or something like that to give them extra flavor. So I'm going to go ahead and boil the potatoes, and once they're nice and tender, I'm going to remove them from the heat and put them in a bowl and let them drain. And I always dump the water out of the pot, put the potatoes back in the hot pot, and stir them around a little bit to evaporate the excess water out of the potatoes, dry them out, so to speak, in the bottom of the pot. Then I'll add about 1/4 cup of melted butter and mash them really good at that point, season them a little bit. Then you can move them off to the side and keep them warm. That's going to be the topping for this game pie. You with me so far?
Yeah.
Huh? Okay, good. Now what I'm going to do, I'm going to go ahead in a nice pot. I'm going to heat up about, 2 tablespoons, 3 tablespoons. I like bacon fat. I like duck fat. I also like vegetable oil. So some vegetable oil. And then I'm going to put into that my cubed game meat or ground meat. I would, like I say, you could cube 3 different meats, let's say about 1/4 inch, 1/2 inch. Put it in the pot and stir fry it until it's golden brown and you get those good creamies in the bottom of the pot.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And then once that's nice and golden brown, I would add 1 cup of diced onions. 1/2 cup of diced celery, 1/2 cup of diced bell peppers, a nice 1/4 cup of that beautiful sliced garlic, thinly sliced. I throw in maybe a teaspoon or two of seeded jalapenos for a little extra spice,
yeah.
Right? And then I stir fry that with all of those beautiful seasonings. You with me?
Uh-huh.
And then I would cover it with about 1 inch or so of a good beef stock. Maybe 1 inch, 1.5 inches. Put it on low and just simmer it until it just gets so tender the meat is falling apart. That's going to take about 1.5 to 2 hours. You with me?
Yeah.
And that's going to drain all.
It's a long time.
Yeah, it's going to simmer all the way down until that meat starts to kind of almost fry again in the bottom of the pot. You want just a little juice down in there, not too very much, if you're with me. You got that? All right. Then what I'm going to do is season it, of course, as I mentioned, with salt, pepper, a little Creole seasoning if you want. Then I'm going to transfer that meat into a casserole dish. You know, you want to put a nice casserole dish. And now you're going to have about 2 cups of a whole kernel corn. You can get canned corn and drain it if you want to. If you in the season, you can slice some nice corn on the cob. Corn's always available in the store anyway. And you can get about 2 full cups. And you're going to put the meat in a casserole dish. And then you're going to top it with the corn and just kind of mix all of that around. Then you're going to top that with those mashed potatoes. So the mashed potato becomes the top of that. And then you're going to sprinkle that with a little bit cheddar cheese. Because remember, this is an English recipe from cheddar country. About 1 cup. And then you're going to put that in the oven and you're going to bake it. Now remember, all the meat is nice and tender already. It's all mixed down in there. You've added just enough onions and celery and all that great seasonings to flavor it beautifully. And you kept just enough juice down in that meat to keep it moist, you know what I mean? And and it's falling apart. In other words, you can almost take your fork. I always said a plastic fork test, right?
Right.
You take a little plastic fork and you push through the meat. If you can push through with a plastic fork without breaking it, it's tender enough. And especially if you have three different games, you can imagine that the rabbit would cook before the goose because the goose is a tougher meat, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of play your game there, but you cannot overcook this meat. That's the main thing. Because as long as you're adding water and you're simmering it, you want to break it down anyway. So if it gets too tender when the meat's falling apart, that's a good thing.
That's a good thing.
You with me? And you want to remember, game, for all practical purposes, are available and no charge, right, for the soldiers. All they had to do was go out on a hunting expedition. So they could bring in all the meat they wanted, especially in the unbelievably game-rich marshlands of Louisiana.
You're in that
season. I mean, there's so much game, and you're in the heart of game season, right in the middle of it. So you have all you want, and you have all the varieties you want. And you could even make your shepherd's pie, which was good, in a cast iron pot. You could cook it over a wooden fire. You could boil your potatoes, which were cheap.
Mm-hmm.
The game was free. So you could have this extravagant meal. So anyway, yeah, so the shepherd's pie with the potato topping gave a hearty meal, rich in game flavor. Easily done, good campfire stores around that pot while it was cooking. And y'all, the good news, the recipe is on the website. jfalse.com, go to the radio, start it up, and I guarantee you, well, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have all of the information on the boucherie and all of that loaded up with pictures of the pig pen and everything else. So you visit our website often and keep in touch with us.
I was just going to say that I'm sure this lost in the marsh venison pie, I'm sure that was much better than the MREs.
Yeah, oh yeah, no doubt about it.
I'm just saying.
And that's what I was guessing.
And I am sure that every Louisiana soldier in the theater was cooking this type of food rather than MREs. Y'all, celebrate the victories that brought us to the freedoms that we have today. And y'all, give the person next to you a hug because they're probably responsible for it in some way themselves all the way down the line. Y'all be safe, and we'll see you soon.